You are listening to Barrel Roll, the official podcast of WingDamage.com.
Yeah, I need to learn life to ease my mind. I need to find someone to call mine. My mama said you can't hurry love.
Hello and welcome to Barrel Roll, the official podcast of WingDamage.com. This is episode 144, and I'm your host, Jonah Gregory. With me tonight, Jesse Gregory.
Hello.
And Adam Ananea.
Yo, yo.
So how's it going?
Yo, yo,
guys.
It's going pretty well. Actually, I had kind of a minor shock yesterday.
Oh, did you now?
Just a little bit. Actually, while we were doing the MegaCast. And I try not to. We were talking to a couple of guys from Capcom, Greg, who we've had on before, and Brett, who is the new guy at Unity.
Mm-hmm.
And they like casually mentioned that Sean Baxter had left Capcom.
Oh,
and I, Jesse had known about it, but I.
Oh yeah, he made a post about it.
Yeah, and I eventually went and I found the post, but I guess just because of my work here, like my work or something, I just didn't happen to come across it. So that was kind of news to me. Did you guys ever mention it on this show?
No, it was really recently.
Okay, well, yeah, it's actually a couple weeks back now. It was in late November.
Oh, it feels really recently.
Yeah.
maybe it was only a week ago.
Yeah.
But a week and a half. But yeah, I mean, that I just, you know, I didn't notice that until now, and I felt kind of bad about it. I'm sure he's moving on to greener pastures or whatever, or you know, just it's a rough business from what I've heard. You know, being in the video game business, can be a lot of stress, and people change hands pretty quickly. But Sean's a very cool guy. I shouldn't say was. I mean, he's still alive.
I assume he's still cool.
Yeah, he's still quite cool, still quite alive.
Changed to another company and just became a total jerk. I don't know what happened.
No.
But yeah, I mean,
he's cool. We've played Monster Hunter with him before.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and I love Monster Hunter a lot, in a big part because of him. If not you, Jesse, then he
right.
also contributed to that. And
to a much lesser extent, I was there sometimes.
And to tell you the truth, like with him leaving Capcom, I do kind of wonder like what support Monster Hunter will have in the U.S. from now
on.
Yeah,
he was as far as Capcom Unity is concerned anyway, he was one of the big guys actually making all the Monster Hunter related posts on Unity.
Yeah.
So I know Greg plays, hopefully he can pick up some of that slack. I don't think he's quite as into it as Sean was. But
yes, that's the
hopefully
thing. Like,
we can. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you can get someone to talk about Monster Hunter and post on Monster Hunter and even like play the game and, you know about it. But Sean was just so passionate about Monster Hunter.
Right, yeah. Aside from just him being a cool guy, that's an additional reason why it's sad to see him go, because we're having kind of a trouble time getting Monster Hunter news in the U.S. right now. So we need all the people fighting for that we can.
Yeah, exactly. It could be a group effort with you guys and this guy Milo that we work with, because, man, that guy, I love his Monster Hunter.
I gotta get back into it. Maybe if I'm wily enough, I will pick up a Japanese 3DS.
Get one of those crazy Monster Hunter bundles that they're going to have over there.
And
yeah, 3G is, like, right about to drop, isn't it?
If not right about to, it pretty much has, I think.
Yeah, it's
definitely
seems
this
like,
week,
if yeah,
not
it
already.
Seems like it. I just saw a post about, like, how many it either had shipped or was going to ship.
Yeah, I think they said, I want to say it was the 4th, even though that's an odd, I think, when do games in Japan typically come out? I'm not sure. Might be Thursday.
You would know better than we would.
You'd be surprised. It's not like I go to the game store every day.
Yeah, fair enough.
But yeah.
It's not like we go to the Japanese game store any day,
yes,
ever.
This is true.
I mean, you know, Sean did a lot to interact with the fans and get them excited, so now we have to carry the torch.
Yes.
We have to
somehow make
Japan, or make all the Monster Hunter stuff come out here on our own, magically.
Yeah.
All I know is if another one does come out here, I'm sure we will talk a lot about it on the show, because that's pretty much inevitable.
It's Mega Man and Monster Hunter we have to report now, or back up.
Yeah, all these different franchises that we have to try and make people care about.
Yeah.
Well, if Monster Hunter 4 like doesn't make it over here, like, I already, like, our other buddy that we play a lot with is already, like, trying to, like, already saying things about, like, possibly importing a system for
Wow, how do you feel about that yourself?
Well, I mean, it would be so far down the road. I would much, much, much prefer, obviously, it come to the U.S.,
but yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I would definitely consider it, especially since by the time it got released in Japan, it would be, you know, a decent amount of time from now, I would think, because 3G is just coming out.
You know, and obviously, I mean, we should probably move on from this soon, but do you think because it's with Nintendo that there's a greater chance it might be brought over to America? Because
I definitely do, yeah, because I think Nintendo really wants a lot of, you know, more games on their system, so
yeah,
people
definitely.
Will buy it. And, you know, they're, I mean, Monster Hunter's not, like, super huge here, but there's at least some people that could potentially buy a system for that, because the people who do play it are, like, really into it.
Yeah.
Do we know how well Tri actually did? I mean, I know it was, like, the most played game online, but that's because you pretty much play it online the whole time.
Yeah.
So
I'm not really sure what the sales numbers were.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, back on the whole, like, would it come out here subject, kind of whenever that conversation came up, I was always thinking, ever since 4 got announced, I completely, like, think that 3G will not make it here, which is fine if they bring 4 over. And the reason I say that is because on the Wii, they came out with, I think, a 2G that they released on the Wii in Japan only. And
That's right. Yeah, you're right.
And then that was just to kind of get started with Monster Hunter on
like
that system
while they were making
the actual new one, which was 3, and then they did bring 3 over. So I'm thinking the same thing could potentially be happening here.
They have
3G, and then that's going to tide over like the fans in Japan. They kind of get their feet wet on the 3DS hardware, and then, you know, get their work done on 4 and then bring that one over, skipping 3G for localization. As long as they bring 4 over,
yes,
I'm fine with them skipping 3G.
What's funny is that the 3DS's horrible battery life will make it so you're pretty much plugged in the entire time you're playing that game. I was just thinking,
wow. Now that you mentioned that, that's wild. That's depressing.
That is a valid point.
I mean, I hate to rag on that, but it is pretty terrible battery life.
What is it, like 3 hours?
They say 3 to 5, but realistically.
Right, and I think the 3
when Jesse's
is,
playing with the volume all the way up and the brightness all the way up and the 3D all the way up at all times, then it's like 2.5.
My experience will always be whatever the minimum battery life is.
Exactly.
The way I play things.
He refuses to not have brightnesses turned up all the way, which I really don't blame you, because a lot of games do look better with the brightness turned up on handhelds.
Right. Oh, you know, since we're already talking about Monster Hunter, I might as well briefly mention that they just confirmed today, I think it was from an Iwata Asks column, that concept trailer that they released for Monster Hunter 4 was, in fact, all like a demo build, essentially, that staff was playing. So it's like all that stuff that I did that post, you know, where I was kind of analyzing all the different things about the trailer, those should all actually be gameplay tweaks, or at least stuff that they're considering, not just a bunch of, like, cinematics.
That's pretty cool.
Indeed.
All right, well, let's actually get into one of our real segments. I mean, this segment has been called Monster Hunter Chat, and we'll move on to the new games coming out this week. So the Wii is getting Fortune Street, which if you didn't already know what this is, you wouldn't know what this is, because the cover kind of tells you. I mean, there's like various characters and there's some dice, but it's like it's a board game. But from what I've been reading, unlike Mario Party, it's actually one that requires some level of skill. I mean, obviously there's going to be luck involved because there's dice rolls and whatnot. And I guess
you mean
there
at the end of it, they don't just roll a dice to see who wins.
No, I've been hearing actually this one has a lot of strategy to it. Like, it's basically
didn't get enough stars, have a star.
Yeah, exactly. But this one is apparently it's kind of a different take on Monopoly. but using Mario and Dragon Quest characters of all things. So you can play as a slime, which already kind of wins me over. But the thing that makes it sound cool is rather than just like you buy properties like Monopoly, there's this whole like investing thing that can make it so even if you don't get the best properties, but you've invested well, you can still win. And it actually sounds like it has a lot of layers to the strategy to it. And I'm a big board game fan anyway, so this really appeals to me. Even with the weird aesthetic of combining Dragon Quest and Mario characters, which is funny because the monsters kind of fit in, but then you see some of the like regular human characters and they look really out of place standing next to Mario.
Nice. Yeah, I saw on the joystick review there, like, it's better if you first go to the options, set the text speed all the way up and the amount of like coins it takes to win all the way down.
Oh, weird. So
apparently it lasts too long otherwise.
Yeah.
I think this is actually a series that has been running a pretty long time in Japan.
Yeah.
I think they call it Itadaki Street.
Right. I've seen other versions of it. I think they're like on DS and who knows what other systems. But yeah, it's definitely something I've seen reference to before.
I don't know much about it, but I think actually Jeremy Parrish is like a pretty big fan of this.
That wouldn't surprise me because he seems to be very knowledgeable about obscure stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but yeah, that one looks or sounds really cool. I mean, it looks okay and cutesy and goofy, and I'm okay with that. But yeah, it's definitely one that I want to at least rent and see if the actual board game itself is fun enough to justify owning the game. But yeah, so there's that, and then this is a real name, right? Drawsome Tablet for the Wii?
Yes.
It's like awesome, but
I gotta
drawing.
Get a job in marketing so that I can come up with stuff like this and get paid for it.
Well, usually the goofy junk that we make up as a joke is not as goofy as some of the stuff that's been coming out lately, so...
I can step it up a notch. They can hire me to do this stuff.
Exactly. So this is from Ubisoft.
Yeah, this is Ubisoft's answer to THQ's drawing tablet.
Yeah, so now you could have multiple drawing tablets that I think use games. Apparently this one has some sort of Smurf games built into it or something.
I didn't even look.
Sign me up!
So, yeah, that's that. The Adventures of Tintin the Game for Wii, 360, PS3, and 3DS is the movie tie-in game.
Yep.
And that looks kind of creepy with the CG, but not, it's a weird mix where it's not quite real, but it still has the weird ass Tintin art, and it just creeps me out.
Like if cartoons came to life, like in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, but in a bad way.
The ones that look kind of human, but not quite came to life. Yeah. So yeah. And then, 3DS is getting F1 2011. So it's, F1 racing. Franchise.
Race in a circle in 3D.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And then Wii and 3DS are getting Oregon Trail, which is what you expect. It's the Oregon Trail.
Do you know who this must be marketed to? Is like people who would see that name and be like, I remember playing Oregon Trail.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll immediately, you know, then you immediately think of either hunting or
dying of dysentery.
Dying of dysentery. Or doing the rafting if you ever actually got that far.
I did quite frequently, actually.
I think in like my class, like, we didn't, for the longest time, we didn't even know that that was a thing in the game, and someone got to it, and that actually stopped class because everyone had to watch.
Did they hit a rock and get everyone killed?
I'm pretty sure they failed.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen anyone beat Oregon Trail. And because you have all those awesome memories as a kid, it kind of inclines you to want to get it, but... I just have a feeling it would be really lame.
Yeah. I kind of would rather just get an emulator of the original, like, green Apple II version. Because that's the one I remember. And then,
like,
you know.
Especially in this day and age, they couldn't be that realistic with, like, the hunting and stuff. And
yeah, exactly.
And letting you name your family really terrible things.
We could only hope. All right, so I guess we'll move on to the news then.
All right.
All right, So we got some pretty good news. Xenoblade Chronicles is coming out in the U.S. in April. It was still kind of rumor-ish when we first added it to the show notes, but by now it's actually on Nintendo's website where you can pre-order it. The weirdest part about it is it's exclusive to GameStop and the Nintendo Online Store. So I'm wondering if they're still very reluctant to just put it out in the wild, and this will allow them to do a pretty low run of it, is my
theory. Yeah, that's definitely my thoughts, is they're intending to do a limited run so that they can release enough to basically just satisfy all
the people. So buy two copies, and 3 years from now, sell one of them, because, oh my god, if this game is rare, I mean,
actually, I have a feeling that's probably not a bad idea.
Well, the other thing is, and I haven't actually looked into this or seen if there's been any update since, but I've been hearing some people saying that with the wording Nintendo has put out, it seems to be a U.S. exclusive, so Canada is not getting it.
Oh, man, that's unfortunate.
Yeah,
that's
a rumor. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a rumor that hasn't, you know, people, friends of mine in Canada are like, you know, worriedly questioning this, like,
right.
Can we get some sign that it's coming out in Canada?
Yeah, that would suck. I feel bad for people in Canada if that is true, because I know there's a lot of gamers up there that were also like part of that Operation Rainfall, you know, that were trying to get this brought over to North America, not just the United States. What is wrong with you, Nintendo? But I am planning on pre-ordering that this week, actually, now that it's official, because I want to make sure I get a copy, because it sounds like it's going to be pretty limited.
Any regrets, Jesse?
No. Okay. I really has enjoyed the time I've spent with it so far, and the fact that I played it when it came out in Europe allowed me to be playing it at the same time as some other people and have some enjoyable discussion about it, so no, I don't regret it.
Oh, good, good.
Also, there's a slight chance it won't have the amazing British voice acting in the U.S. release. We don't know yet what's going to happen with the localization. Could go either way.
That's true. We have no idea.
I have to imagine that it would, because when the British people talk, it sounds like English words.
Uh-huh.
And
it's kind
making,
of like that.
Changing the voices again costs money.
It does, I know. And but, you know, it worked so well for Dragon Quest VIII. I really don't want them to change the voices.
Yeah, I was actually watching like a video of it, and I just think, wow, that sounds good.
Yeah.
I think there's something about just British accent in general that, you know, it makes it sound more like professionally acted.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is, to me anyway, and maybe it's just because fantasy movies always substitute everything for British accent, but when it's a like fantasy setting, it just seems better to me.
Yeah, I can see that, especially.
Maybe it's just because it's more convincing to hear a British guy tell you about like the Sword of Eternity than it is to hear some American guy.
Yeah. Especially considering like so much medieval lore comes from Europe and Britain. It's fits.
It's a personal preference thing, because I know random people on the internet who I probably would never want to meet in real life are like hoping that they get it because they don't like that, and I'm just like, what is wrong with you? They're the same people who are like complaining when a JRPG didn't have English voice acting. I'm like, really? I'm gonna slap you in the face. What is wrong with you people?
Well, I can actually see that point of view. I thought you were talking about the opposite, when people like are screaming that the Japanese voices are better.
No.
That's a whole big bowl of fish, or whatever you want to call that.
Delicious. I just know that it's going to be terrible voice acting either way, but if it's in another language, I can't tell that it's terrible. I just am reading it, so I really don't care. So that's actually why I can really not watch any anime that isn't in Japanese, with rare exception. I mean, obviously there's a few. We've mentioned this before, but usually, because I'm sure a lot of shows have really bad voice acting by their standards as well, but you'd never know it if you don't speak the language.
That should be that. Yeah, I agree with you there. Like, I am a proponent for like actual having English voiceovers and stuff, just because I think something should match the culture it's being marketed to and what people would expect. But at the same point, yes, it has to be an actual good job.
Yes.
Which is going to
That's where the disconnect is, unfortunately.
Okay.
Yeah, there are sadly a lot of companies that are just like, I got this relative that he can do the voices for like $5, you know.
It was like my mom
can talk.
A lot of games in the US that used to be, you know, when they first started doing voices, and even developers have made and kind of joked about this when they, cause you know, their companies had done it too. And like in the early 90s, you know, when multimedia stuff was getting big, and they're like, yeah, we didn't have voice actors to hire. They didn't exist yet. So it would literally be like the guy from the marketing department or something who had, you know, some free time would come down and record voices.
Well, and I think there is like something to say for like when you're looking at Japanese news, like for gaming news, a lot of times when they release, you know, like an RPG or something over there, they'll be like, and then this voice actor is a part of it, and this voice actor is a part. Like, people actually are looking
actually
at specific voice actor names and caring. It's like, that doesn't happen over here. Unless it's like the rare exception where it's like, you know, oh, Patrick Stewart did this bit of narration for it or something like that. But it just
Ron
seems
Perlman
like it's more...
is the guy that says War never changes, you know.
Yeah. So it's like...
He was helpful.
It does seem like they care about voice acting more than we care about dubbing over their voice acting.
Right.
We get some decent voice actors for the games that we make.
Yeah.
But most of the time when we localize the games from Japan, then they just get whoever they can grab.
It's really weird.
That's why the Japanese voices are usually better. It's just the sad state of how a lot of localizations, and, you know, not all of them. Like, you know, there are some bigger budget ones, like... With the one exception of the awful, awful character Vanille, everybody else in Final Fantasy 13 I thought had a pretty decent voice.
Mm-hmm. And she was like the space Australian accent.
She was the space Australian. She was the worst thing ever. Every time she opened your mouth, you're just like, oh, God. But every other character was like, hey, these voices are actually, this is pretty good dubbing. Good job, guys.
Hey, speaking of localizations, I guess that rolls right into the next thing, Final Fantasy Type-0. The team is working on a Western version, but they haven't actually confirmed that a Western version is coming out. Is that the thing?
Apparently, there was this like ultimatum guide thingy for Final Fantasy Type-0 that like in that guide was talking about how the team's now working on the Western version of the game.
Huh.
But the Square Enix still, as far as I can tell, has not officially announced that it is coming overseas. They've always just hinted at it. They've been like, well, we're considering bringing it overseas, but
right. Well, you were saying based on the demo, it seemed pretty cool, right?
Yeah. There was this really like beefy demo that they released that I played through all of and talked about on the show. And,
right.
From what I played, there was, you know, several stages, and it seemed like a really cool action RPG that seemed to have like a lot of polish for, you know, being a PSP game.
Mm. Did it just come out over there?
I think it was. You know, I forget exactly because it got delayed a few times, but I think it might have been an October release or it used to be and then end up being a November release. But yeah, I think it just came out over there.
Okay.
But yeah, that's the story. According to like a guide they released that said that the team is working on the Western version. So that's a pretty good sign that we'll be seeing it over here, which would be good.
I hope so. Cause I don't know. The PSP seems like a good home for a lot of these type of games where it's like they can do kind of a bigger game and it's still flashy and cool looking, but I don't know what I'm trying to say. It just seems like the perfect spot for it based on other releases that have come out on PSP. It just seems to fit. I don't know. Maybe it's just...
I don't know. It's just like as the Vita gets closer and closer, it's like anytime there's a cool PSP game that's like, you know, a Japanese RPG or whatever, I have less and less confidence of it coming over here, especially after Valkyria Chronicles 3.
Yeah, that was a sucky situation.
And the fact that they wouldn't just, like, confirm Final Fantasy Type-0, like, because most of the time with a Final Fantasy game, they'll just be like, they'll announce it, and then they'll be like,
right.
And it's coming in the U.S.
They'll
and
be
they
like,
might
and
even
of
release...
course it's coming out in the U.S.
Right, and a lot of times they'll even, like, release U.S. trailers, like, almost immediately after the Japanese ones and all that stuff, and like none of that happened with Type Zero, and they would never, and I think pretty sure they still haven't officially said it's coming over here, so it was getting a bit worrisome.
Yeah, that's too bad. I hope it does. It seems pretty sweet.
It's looking pretty good now.
Yeah.
With this latest element.
And speaking of the Vita, they revealed the pricing on the memory cards for that, which is kind of a weird story in that we're talking about it, but it seemed to be worth mentioning just because they're so ridiculously expensive, because they're using various sizes from 4 gigs to 32, but they start at $30, go up to $45 for the 8 gig, $70 for the 16, and $120 for the 32 gig.
That's ridiculous.
And the games are going to be the $40 price point, like the 3DS games, and the console itself is $250 or $300, depending on if it's the 3G one or not. So
are these proprietary memory cards? Like,
that's
you have to
the
buy
problem.
Theirs?
Yeah, that's why it's an issue. Because if they had just used those standard HD or high capacity ones that already exist, those little tiny ones. Which is funny because a lot of those are from Sony that you'd think it would use those, and it doesn't. And that seems
really
stupid to everyone, apparently.
So the least you can spend on a card is still $30?
For a 4 gig is all, too.
So, and that actually, now that you mention it, this is a download-only console.
Yeah. Well, it has cartridges.
Oh, I guess, no, it isn't. Yeah, they're doing it both ways. I forgot about that. They're releasing the game cartridges and download versions at the same time.
Oh, well, I believe there's been an update that the 4 gig cards are actually only $25. They're $5 cheaper than everyone.
Oh, wow.
And the 8 gig
all
is
the difference.
$40 instead of $45.
So basically what you're telling me is that if they don't include any kind of SD card, or whatever card, that if you're going to spend the least amount you could possibly spend is somewhere around, like, was that $330 or something for the low-end PSP model, the low-end card, and one game?
Yeah, that's insane.
And then, that would be like $330-ish or something when that would before tax.
Yeah.
Man, that adds up fast.
Yep. Well, even if you look at, because I saw this on Joystick, that's where I got the info from. And even their little intro paragraph is pretty funny, because he's talking about when you're grudgingly putting your money down for the proprietary Vita memory card and muttering under your breath about how absurd it is that neither an industry standard SD card nor Sony's own memory stick will work. It's like, really, guys? What were you thinking? It sounds like they were trying so hard to make the Vita, like, use parts that weren't ridiculous for a change and were kind of, like, off the shelf to keep the price lower, and then they do this. It just seems so weird.
It's one of those things where they're kind of shooting themselves in the foot, but, like, I think the idea behind it, to go into ulterior motives, is that it's kind of like when you go on eBay and somebody has, like, a really great deal, but then they put the shipping cost super high.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, yeah, the system's only $250, and then it's like, oh, you want a memory card that can actually hold the games that you're going to be downloading?
Well,
you know,
that
it could
and
be
some games
$70 or something.
Saving. Yeah.
And the thing about that is that, people are going to see those memory card prices, and it's going to turn off a lot of people, unfortunately.
It already turned me off to caring nearly as much. I was kind of psyched for the Vita, and now I'm like, eh.
Well, especially when you can, like, go on Amazon and get an 8 gigabyte card for a regular SD card for, like, $20 at the most. You can get, like, a super cheap one by an off-brand if you really had to have one.
Mm-hmm.
But, it'll do its job.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that just seems really wrong.
You think they would have learned after UMDs.
Yeah, you really would. I don't understand it. Sony, get with the program.
It's weird, too, because, like, I don't know, this seems like there's a lot of... There's not as much motivation to get a Vita right away, because it's like a lot of the cool games are also coming to PS3.
Yeah,
there's like Dragon's
weird.
Crown and whatnot. It's like, oh, that looks like a cool, RPG beat-em-up, but it's like...
For the system I already own.
You don't need a Vita to play it.
Yeah.
Now, I did find out, though, that it seems like that wipeout is not actually for both things. That one was a weird situation where they kept talking about how, oh, you could play multiplayer with the Vita and the PS3. It's going to be so cool. But then I saw the wording on this other post that was talking about, oh, yeah, and then there are select tracks that are taken from the Wipeout HD Fury version that those can be played with players of that on PS3. So that means that they probably aren't actually making a PS3 version, at least at this time, of that Wipeout 2048, which is a shame because I really do want to play that Wipeout. I just don't think I $330-some-odd want to play that Wipeout.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Yeah, that's... Oy. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Okay, so Atlas actually came out to comment on the King of Fighters 13 online play situation. Last week, Jesse had kind of filled us in on... it was kind of sketchy, you were saying. Like, you had a couple games that were fine and some that seemed like they're in slow motion almost.
Yeah, it was, like I was saying, it was a complete range of quality from having zero problems to lots of problems, depending on the match.
Yeah. So they came out basically just to say that, you know, they've been monitoring the dialogue of fans and the feedback they've been getting and, so they're saying, like, that they're, you know, they're working on, you know, improving things, essentially, on the network performance and stuff. That it sounds like it may be networking issues, you know, with on their end. So, I mean, it sounds like they are aware that it's not running as smoothly as they were hoping, so they're working
on it.
Yeah,
and
so
it was still leaps and bounds above 12.
Yeah,
12 that one was just completely broken.
Yeah.
13 was all across the board. But yeah, it would be nice if they could tighten that up a bit because King of Fighters 13 is a super awesome fighter as it is. It's just it has some hiccups online still.
Yeah. All right. And then lastly, the Super Boy has officially come out, which is the thing that lets you play Super Nintendo games on the go legitimately. Like, you can put in your actual cartridges and take it with you, and it has a little screen, you know, built into it, and it looks like a Super Nintendo controller, more or less.
You know what I like about the Super Boy is that it's not just a portable game system and like the Game Boy sense, but it's also a portable game system in the you can take it and like plug regular controllers into it sense.
That's what
well.
I was getting to. Yeah, you can actually hook it up to your TV and use it as your Super Nintendo and plug in real like the actual controllers and stuff.
Right. So it's like a big ass Game Boy that plays Super Nintendo games and a small Super Nintendo.
Yeah.
Like
exactly.
That you can plug into your TV.
Yeah.
So it's cool that it's like dual function like that. That's the one thing I thought was coolest about it.
Yeah, didn't they try and do that with that crazy Sega Genesis thing, the Nomad? That didn't go so well.
Is that what like I remember the name Nomad.
It was Toys R Us exclusive.
Nomad. Yeah. It was a portable Genesis. I don't think you could plug it in.
Well, there you go. Same thing then.
I don't think you could plug it in and like use it on your TV. It's just to take Genesis games with you and yeah,
never mind.
I remember finding out way later that it was Toys R Us exclusive, which I didn't know at the time.
Gotcha.
I just thought it was really weird and because I would always peruse the game section at Toys R Us. I also was like, oh, these redesigned top loading NESs, who would want those? And now I'm like, man, I should have bought 10 of those.
Yeah, pretty much. The other cool thing about the Super Boy, and this is like totally a collector's thing, but like if you're going around like shopping for, you know, classic games, you can just whip it out and be like, does this cartridge work? Bam. Yes, it does.
Yes, because we've had some bad experiences.
I have gone home with cartridges before and a big old sad face. I'll just say that.
Exactly.
Sometimes you buy from, you know, a vendor at some con that, you know, you'll never see again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes they just don't work.
That's what I was going to say. It's like by the time Retro Game Con comes back to Seattle, I hope to have one of these for that very reason, because that would be awesome to just be able to take that with, because that was like Tupperware bin upon Tupperware bin just crammed full of Super Nintendo games and other
things. Right, and that's the thing too, is like everybody always says we test our cartridges, but sometimes like just from, you know, the handling of all the customers, something can happen between them testing it and you getting it.
Exactly.
And so, you know, there even people who are really good about enforcing their testing policies, sometimes just through, you know, bad circumstance, you can still end up with a cartridge that ends up not working.
Exactly. All right, guys. So, well, let's why don't we take a break and then come back and talk about what we've been playing. So let's talk about what we've been playing. All right, Adam, you played some Assassin's Creed Revelations.
I am actually playing it right this moment.
Wow.
I've been playing it the whole show.
I see.
That's how that's how dedicated you are to this show.
Well, I've got problems with the game.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually, now that I'm in a position I can start looking at a bigger picture of the series, this is kind of a thing I've begun to get concerned about from Brotherhood. Because I think if you remember my review, like, I ultimately liked Brotherhood, but felt cold on it somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just didn't seem as satisfying, even though it was, you know, essentially another entry into the game, into the series. But basically what it comes down to is Ubisoft trying to fix what was never broken.
Okay. Oh.
Namely, okay, let me set this up.
You're an assassin.
Yes, hold on.
Okay.
This was the real turning point for me in this game. Is when I'm following along the story. I'm still very early into the game. I think I'm like on the third chapter. And so in they use these early chapters to basically teach you how to do all of the things in the game. Because they'll introduce those aspects as like missions that you have to do to progress the story. But then you also learn how to use this thing just in your regular going around in the city. And so we have these assassins' dens. They've carried over the whole thing from Brotherhood, where like there are these Templar dens that you can overthrow and turn them into assassins' dens. And so you go to your assassin's den, which is already in place, and you're talking to some new character, and then they're like, hey, Ismar, whatever, I don't know what his name is. They're all Constantinople in this time. And so it's hard to remember names. But they're like, the Templars are coming. We have to fight them off. And I'm thinking like, yeah, all right, it's action time. I'm going to get out there and just, you know, murder some people. That's awesome. And then the scene changes, and I'm standing on top of a roof, looking over, like, a street, and it's asking me to position troops. I'm trying to think, what? What's going on here? It's showing me how to, like, put assassin leaders so you can increase your morale, which is a type of currency, and then place gunmen and other assassins and barrier walls. I'm thinking, is this a tower defense game?
Sounds like it.
And that's what it was. And then waves of Templar troops come, and you just stand there as you place other troops and watch them take all the action. And I'm thinking, why am I playing a tower defense game in Assassin's Creed? Of course, what really sucks for me is the fact that I can't stand tower defense games.
Right.
Yeah.
But even if I enjoy them, I would not buy Assassin's Creed wanting to play tower defense. I mean, it might be a pleasant surprise, but you buy Assassin's Creed because you want to run through streets and run on rooftops and stab people in the back.
Yeah.
And that's why Assassin's Creed 2 got so popular, was that
you know, it took that aspect from the first game and, like, added more ways to do that and made it more fun to do. And then, like, when Brotherhood started coming out, and I actually remember watching a video where Ubisoft or Ubisoft, I can never remember which one it is, was talking about it.
But yeah, basically, and in this video I'm watching, Ubisoft saying, like, they want to add more of these creative, clever things. I can't remember what they were calling them. I was calling them gimmicks.
Because that's more accurate than whatever they were saying.
They were basically describing them as any kind of gameplay that's not part of the normal gameplay.
Yeah,
but it's the normal gameplay that drew me in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, I was actually really... Well, see, here's what happens later, is that if you... How do I say? Your Assassin's Den can actually be retaken over by the Templars.
Okay.
And I think that's... I actually looked this up a little while ago. There have to be certain conditions, like if you're, like, really highly wanted, or one of your assassin recruits dies, and you have less assassin power, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can contest your ownership of that citadel or whatever. Citadel is a Russian term, but you know what I mean.
So if
that happens, you have to go back and, you know, do a tower defense game again to defend
That's not good.
And no, it's not good, because I don't want to have to have that always coming up just when I'm trying to enjoy the game.
And there's no, like, alternate way to do it. You have to do the tower defense game. You can't just, like, go out and kill the dudes pre that being a thing, right?
Well, that's the thing. Is, like, I was wondering if it did come up, maybe if I just ignored it long enough, they would say, like, okay, the Templars won and reclaimed it. And so then you can actually go back in the normal way, which is, like, to take it over again, like, from scratch, and to go in and assassinate the Templar leader. And even then, that's kind of annoying to always have to have that going on when you're trying to take care of other stuff.
Yeah.
Playing the game at your pace. You don't want that always coming up, because then that, like, affects... You know, I think that affects, like, the number of assassins you can have recruited and stuff like that.
It sounds incredibly inconvenient.
It is. You know, it's kind of like in Grand Theft Auto 4 when your friends would constantly bug you.
They're constantly calling your cell phone and asking you to go party with them.
Yeah, and then, like, throwing a fit when you wouldn't.
Going to see a Ricky Gervais stand-up act. That's something you can do.
Wow. Huh. But yeah, it's like that, and I don't know why they thought that was a good idea. And the funny thing is, like... From Assassin's Creed 2, Ezio was you were basically a one-man army.
Yeah.
Like, by the end of the game, you were taking on 10 guys at once on your own, like, huge, heavy-armed guys with axes and stuff, and you were a complete murder machine. And that's an awesome feeling that, like, you're this one-man army. And when Brotherhood came out, the basic theme of that game is, you can't be a one-man army.
Well, you're old now, right? Maybe.
Yeah, but that doesn't make a difference.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's lame.
Yeah, it's lame. And shoot, even Solid Snake can still take care of things on his own as an old man.
By which you mean try to avoid people.
That's true.
Please don't find me. I'm old.
That whole game could have been him staying home in bed.
Yeah.
No one would have noticed.
But yeah, so other weird things... Because you know, most of the city is under Templar control when you start, and it still, of course, has the whole aspect of buying shops and renovating the city and increased income. You can't buy shops in Templar-controlled areas. So you have to clear them first. Yeah, you have to clear them first.
So there's no getting around playing this tower defense thing like a million times.
Oh no, no. When you take over a Templar area, that's not tower defense.
Oh, okay.
You have to sneak in and assassinate the. It'll be like you'll be on high alert if you go into that area, which basically means, like, if a guard notices you, he'll immediately be suspicious of you.
Right.
But you have to go in You have to assassinate the Templar leader, and they'll either, depending on their personality type, they'll either try to fight back or run away. And for the most part, they tend to run away. And if they manage to escape from you, you have to wait another day before you can try to take over that place again. And that was something from Brotherhood. I wasn't really crazy about it, but then at the same time, it wasn't really hard to do.
Okay.
And I'll be like standing on a rooftop and just kind of like waiting there
thinking about how I should tackle this.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, out of the blue, like the Templar leader just starts fleeing, and I have no idea.
What? Why?
What's going on? Maybe if you cause too big of a ruckus, he'll start to flee. Because I think one time I sent some thieves in just to hassle some of the guards, and I didn't even know if the Templar leader was there. But all of a sudden, it's this thing like, okay, he's running away. You have to get him right now. And I'm like, wait, what's going on?
That's really weird.
I actually failed a number of those consecutively, which is also making me mad at the game. But with what I was saying about the shops, that you have to win over the area first and then buy the shops to open them so you can use them.
What?
I know.
So it's like they don't even exist until you've bought them?
Pretty much. They're like closed down. And Brotherhood had this.
I think it would be the opposite.
Yeah, that's weird. I thought maybe it'd just give you a discount or something.
Yeah.
I think as you open shops, you do get a discount or something.
Huh.
Like, at least in Brotherhood, it had it. Or maybe it was Assassin's Creed 2 when you're just in that little town, like that was your base. But
yeah,
like,
I thought that was like once you upgraded things, they started giving you discounts.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they still do that. But at least in Brotherhood, I think, like, even if an area was under Templar control, there would still be like some shops that were open that you could... Like, and now it's like, well, apparently, like, no one can be a blacksmith in this whole entire city because there are no blacksmith shops open, so.
Yeah.
You think that would be an inconvenience to other people as well.
Only you, apparently, care about that. Did you get to any of the stuff that calls back the, what's the first dude?
Altair?
Oh, okay. Yeah, not yet.
I was very curious how those are worked into the game.
I have no idea.
I really don't care about spoilers if it was a spoiler thing. So.
I'm sure it will be.
Yeah.
Sure it will be, but...
Well, when you find out, you can tell me off-show, apparently, you know, so we don't spoil it for anybody.
At the rate these games are going, and I do really feel like they're stretching it out too far. It's going to end with them, like, wait, actually, you've been on a UFO the whole time, and it's aliens.
You were actually Ezio the whole time in the future.
Oh,
Desmond was a fever dream of Ezio.
You wake up, and you're a completely different guy that's never been in it before, that was having all those dreams.
He's in the Matrix, and then the guy in the Matrix is having a dream within a dream in Inception that's in a dream.
Yeah.
You know when that guy, Morpheus was like the red pill or the blue pill? This is what happens when you take both. Assassin's Creed.
Exactly.
And wash it down with the vodka.
Well, that's unfortunate. It sounds like they're...
Well, I'm trying to, like, to power through it. And if there's a way...
That's the way your entertainment should be.
Only because it's kind of a hassle to return games from my position.
Right, yeah.
Although, sure. I have ordered the return.
Oh.
I have initiated that, but I haven't... I still need to print out the form and send it in. So I have time to do that, but I'm thinking, like, this is a series I really love. I don't want to judge this so quickly.
Is there a time limit on that return that you've already started it?
I basically have until the 1st of January.
Is it
Amazon? So you still have...
Or?
Yeah, it's through Amazon.
They give you like a month to return stuff.
Okay, well, so you still have a decent amount to try and keep playing it then.
Yeah, like, I think they have to get it by then, but you know, I still have a solid week, I'm sure, because the only problem there is I have to pay to ship it back, so obviously I'm not going to overnight it to them. That's the price of another game.
Yeah, you might as well keep it at that point.
I do like the bomb crafting system a bit. I still haven't messed around with bombs too much, but that's one of the other new things in this game is that you can make all different kinds of bombs, and you find tons of ingredients all over the place. They're in chests, and you pickpocket them off people and stuff. And you can make them actually just bombs to kill people, or bombs to cause distractions, or bombs to, like, aid your escape. And the really nice thing about that is every time you go to the bomb crafting workbench, it's getting a little like Minecraft here, I suppose. I guess
when you craft your bomb, Minecrafts.
Every time you, that's the twist ending. You're actually in Minecraft the whole time.
Nice.
But every time you go to the crafting table, you can, it'll basically let you test whatever you make in like a test area.
Oh, okay.
You can use everything, all of the ingredients, even stuff that you don't actually have. You can still test it and like see what it would do.
Huh.
So that's really useful. And there are some pretty interesting ones. Like you can make something called a caltrops bomb, which if you don't know what I didn't know what a caltrop was, but it's like it throws out like little spikes that, you know, people step on them.
Yeah, those things. They look like jacks, except
yeah,
pointy. Has those.
you can make a bomb with lamb's blood in it.
Okay.
Which basically what it's meant to do is spray people with blood and make them think they've been like horribly wounded. That'll distract them for a little bit until they realize I didn't actually get like a hole blown in my chest.
That's weird.
And then you can make.
Say it attracts werewolves or something really crazy.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of werewolf mechanics that they've added, mm-hmm. just kind of out of left field.
And that'll be the next one. The way these are going.
The whole game has actually been vampires versus werewolves.
It's just Underworld, the game, apparently.
The one that actually doesn't kind of make sense to me is you can make a bomb with pyrite, which somehow creates a bomb that explodes coins out everywhere.
What?
So, like, when the coins explode out, like, all, you know, regular village people will, not the band, but, you know,
yeah,
townspeople will, like, run up and like, you know, want to pick up the coins. And if any guards happen to walk through the area, they'll start, like, messing with the guards and stuff, like, don't take my money!
Huh.
So, it's interesting. And then, of course, you have, like, cherry bombs, which just make a loud noise, and all the guards will walk over to it. There's, like, shrapnel bombs or just bombs that are just really... Actually, my favorite are the poison bombs. You can make bombs that release poison gas. But it's really fun to work with, and I still kind of need to get into it more, because I have plenty of the ingredients.
So that is one of the additions that is actually good, is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's a positive thing. Although I do kind of feel like that there's probably just too many ways to kill people now.
Which one do I choose?
Pretty much. And when you consider that you're only killing people either close or far, there's not a whole lot of stuff you need at your disposal. And the thing is, you actually start the game with a lot of them. They're pretty good about that, where they stop doing the whole thing where they just try to make up excuses for you.
Well,
to
how many times has this guy become the best assassin? This is like the third time just for him, right?
Pretty much, but that's the nice thing. It's like it's not like he's becoming the best assassin. He is now like this legendary assassin that.
Okay, cool.
Which is not a good thing to be that well known. Although it is kind of
yeah, not in that line of work.
It is kind of weird that you do go to Constantinople. And, like, that's when you get the hook blade, which is nice because it makes you climb buildings really quickly.
Yeah, I think they would have invented that a long time ago for these guys.
But that's just the thing,
hook
like.
On a chain, I don't know. That's pretty complicated. Leonardo da Vinci.
It's not a hook on a chain. It's just like a hooked blade that comes out. Huh. But what they have ropes that connect buildings and you can skid down them using the hook. But it is kind of
suspicious of those ropes everywhere.
But you know, there are actually Templars. Like you'll run into them, like hitting them with a hammer.
What?
Hitting the posts with a hammer. I don't know if you just stand there long enough that they'll actually destroy it. But
okay.
Yeah, it's really funny. And you just lock up and kill them.
So I'm wondering if they've been secretly working on the actual numbered 3 one this whole time, or if they're going to rush that one out the door.
I think the idea, at least that fans have, is number 3 is definitely the one that's supposed to come next. Although I remember
they've kind of hinted at that. I thought at this point,
this one supposedly is definitely supposed to tie up the story to Ezio
because it wasn't tied up before.
Of course, you know, then the next game could be about the story of how George Washington wasn't a great assassin or something.
Yeah.
Which I'd actually play that if you're like Abraham Lincoln and a master assassin.
Well, maybe it's just the Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter tie-in game is the next Assassin's Creed.
Abraham Lincoln could not be an assassin because you dive into the haystack and your hat would just be sticking out of it.
But how many weapons can he hold in there, man? That gives him an advantage.
That's true. And
he's
his beard.
He's got a hidden like circular saw in his hat.
But anyway, yeah, that sounds like it's a pretty mixed bag, is what you're saying.
It is. If they could just like bring it back to what it was fun with to begin with. And I know when you have a game that becomes really successful, you become pressured to kind of top yourself. Yeah, but sure. You know, just remember what was in the game that made it so good, because Assassin's Creed 2 was an amazing game and did not have tower defense minigames and did not have like you trying to control a really awkward tank or something.
Was that in Brotherhood you were saying? Those other vehicles? So you're saying 2 sounds like is your favorite as far as overall being a good game.
Yeah, one is actually a very fun game just because even though it's so basic and kind of unbalanced, it's very
straightforward.
State and play it, and
yeah, that's the only one I've played all the way through. I've actually barely played 2 comparatively. I actually played all of 1, and then I went right into 2, and I was like, okay, I need to take a break from these for a while.
I see, yeah.
Yeah, inversely, yeah. Number 2 is the only one I finished.
The 2 is, in my opinion, the perfect balance of like things you can do and how much of an awesome guy you feel like doing them.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, in this game, like, there was some kind of weird chariot race earlier that I kept screwing up.
Weird.
Like, where you're on a carriage and you have to knock it into this other guy's carriage, but it was really...
like a thing that's real, but okay.
Yeah, I was gonna mention something else, but I completely forgot about it, talking about Abraham Lincoln, so... when we were talking about what the next game would be...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I just remembered I was seeing a quote from Ubisoft saying that, like... They'll keep the series going as long as they want to, if it's still popular. So.
As long as it's profitable.
Right.
Even if it seems like they should tie up the story, and this all is supposed to be like this big overlying story that all this stuff connects, they'll keep pumping out games if they think they can get away with it. So,
yeah, and that's the sad thing, is like there are certain things where, like there are certain series where they're just like a vehicle for ideas and story doesn't matter. Like say, you know, like a Mario game or whatever, just like more platformy levels. But something that has an ongoing narrative, that actually suffers when it gets drawn out.
Yeah, like, I don't know, shows that do that, like Lost,
right.
For example, where there's like 3 seasons in the middle that could have been cut.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe they'll go to Caveman Assassins.
Cave Assassin's Creed.
Assassin's Creed.
All right. Well, I guess moving on then. We all played Super Mario 3D Land, and yes. It sounds like Adam did not like it as much as anyone else in the world.
Just in case no one's aware, I've had a whole theme this week where, and I'm not, okay, I'm not like the person, I'm not one of those people who buys games to rip on them. I'm not one of those self-realizing prophecies hater gamers. I buy games because I want to enjoy them, you know?
Yes, no, I get what you're saying.
And I'll get snarky about games, like... I understand, like, for example, the Sonic games, I rip on them a lot, but I'm not really a big Sonic fan anyway, but I more do it out of just how I perceive Sega has treated their customers, which I perceive to be very poorly, but I'm not like, I try not to be one of those actually really just hateful gamers. I like playing games. I like enjoying games.
HatefulGamer.com is your actual website.
Launching in 2012.
But the fact of the matter is, I bought both Assassin's Creed and Mario 3D Land at like the same time they came together, and I was like really excited to get into both of them. And it had been, you know, I did get Star Fox that I should probably play some more from someone.
Yeah, somebody. I don't know.
But like I was, and actually when they came, like I was in Tokyo that day doing the Tamashii Nations event. I was actually really bummed out, like, oh, if I were only home today, I could have been playing those games now. So I was really, and that's the other thing. We always have these discussions about 2D Mario versus 3D Mario.
Right.
But I'm actually not a humongous 3D Mario hater. I think 2D Mario is better, and I think it's more profitable when it's done right.
But like I really enjoyed the first Galaxy. I consider that to be a good game. And I played 3D Land at E3, and I liked what I played. I thought it was interesting. So
yeah, I was kind of surprised to hear you weren't liking it as much, as because it seemed like you had a pretty positive first impression.
Yeah, so that's just it. Like, I was genuinely looking forward to playing this game. I was excited to play it, and then I didn't like it that much.
Okay.
But, well, so, Jesse, I mean, you've already talked about it a bit, right?
Yeah, you were here, I think.
Probably. I was probably zoning out or something.
I've played up through World 6, and then I jumped to Jesse's save and played a couple random special world or whatever, just to see how hard they were.
Mm-hmm.
I personally am not a huge fan of the 3D Mario games. Like, I don't have anything against them, and I think they're good games from what I've played. I never really stick with them and finish them like I would a 2D one.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that being in 3D would make it so I could tell where I was jumping better in a 3D setting. It did not.
Yes. No. I'm there 100%, and that's 99% of why I'm so angry at the game.
Yeah.
Because even with the 3D on, which I did more 3D in this than I have in any other 3DS game, I still was just, you know, I would jump and I'd watch myself land, and wait, I'm not landing, I'm actually falling behind the platform.
Yep, I 100% have to use the shadow underneath my guy to land.
But when you do that, and you're not paying attention to Mario, is he's gonna get hit by a boomerang or something like that.
Or one of the hundreds of thousands of Tanuki tails.
There are a lot of those.
I like how that was in the story, like, intro thing, like, why everything has Tanuki tails, because they're just like, we know people are going to ask us, so here's why.
Yeah, it was cute.
Yeah, I know. It was just, it cracked me up that they actually showed, like, an explanation at all,
right?
Because, you know, they didn't have to, and it was just, the way they did it actually had me laughing. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, it wouldn't have been odd for the Tanuki suit just to come back from Mario, but for the fact that, like, every enemy has it.
Yeah, even Bullet Bills and stuff. That was pretty unexpected.
So weird.
Like, I thought people were joking about how much it was in there until I was actually playing it.
Yeah.
But that said, it's not that I'm not having fun with it. I mean, there's something about the 3D ones I always have a hard time wrapping my head around the 3D platforming. I don't know. It's I guess a personal problem that Adam shares my pain in.
Well, like I said, I do like Galaxy, and Galaxy, in my opinion, was like them taking 3D Mario. Like, I was never good at 64. I hated Sunshine. I played Sunshine
after Galaxy, though, which is, like, not a good thing to do.
Yeah, that was not a good idea. But, Galaxy was finally a 3D Mario game that was, like, I could play it and kind of be good at it. And it really resolved a lot of the physics things and the camera. And it was just, you know, it's not a game I wanted to play over and over again, but it was a good experience.
Mm-hmm.
This is some of my conjecture, but the problem I perceive with Nintendo is that they want to be making more 3D Mario games. Like, mm-hmm. I think they want to make only 3D Mario games. So they keep trying to make it more appealing to the 2D and general gamer crowd. And so,
interjecting the, like, 2D segments and stuff?
Yeah. It seems like every 3D game that comes out, they're trying to push that even more, saying, like, this time, you know, the 2D crowd will definitely be able to get into it. Like, and if you read those, like, Iwata Asks articles, you'll see them say stuff just like that.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think if they want to do 3D, just do it. I mean, there's obviously, it's not, I'm in the minority, or both of us are in the minority, and it's like, I don't even hate the game or anything. I have a really hard time with the platforming in any 3D Mario game. I had the exact same problems in every 3D Mario game ever, because I've played all of them to some degree.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And, like, I'm not going to say people who like 3D Mario games, there's like, something wrong with them or anything. If you like the game, that's fine. But, you know, there are definitely fans who want to play those games that are more focused on kind of the exploration and the kind of solving the simple puzzles. And now, like, Nintendo is kind of dumping on that crowd, too.
Well, yeah, this is what I was talking about last week.
Right, right.
Where it's like, you know, if you're a pure 3D Mario fan, you know, you probably more like that exploration style. And, you know, if you're a pure 2D fan, you like kind of that more speedrun-centric style.
Yeah.
And this is, like, kind of neither.
Yeah, because it does the different levels rather than having a hub. And
yeah.
I don't know. The big thing I have, too, is, like, when they have tried to do 2D stuff now, they use the 3D running physics, and I hate that.
And
oh, they're always going to do that.
I know. It drives me freaking crazy.
You're never going to get the old Mario physics back.
I know. I know. I'm an old man, and I'm grumpy.
Well,
and I miss the 2D physics because, to me, they worked better.
And see, this game tries to trick you with that as well, because even though it is a 3D Mario game, a lot of the stages are basically presented with you going left to right.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not even really a reason to go in towards the foreground or background unless there's a reason to avoid something. So you, and with how the controls are laid out, you kind of want to play it like a 2D Mario, but if you really do that, you're going to end up falling off a cliff or something without realizing it. Because in like a game like this, if you jump in a certain direction and you change your mind, too bad, buddy. If you try to turn yourself around, you just can't go the other way. Mm-hmm. Especially because it's the circle pad that, like, you're not going to hit it straight up, like 180. You're kind of going to curve yourself around and lean towards the foreground or background, and that's a lot of the reason why you're going to end up falling off of a cliff, even though you were going along a plane.
I honestly think I would have been doing better had they let me use the D-pad, even though it's a 3D Mario.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, do they disable that? I never actually bothered
it
to try.
It moves the camera.
Yeah.
And up and down changes. I guess it changes how the 3D works. It's like either the popping
out
or the more flat.
Yeah, there's
look.
Two different kinds of 3D. It's very strange.
Yeah.
I didn't even notice that.
I didn't realize that till I was almost done with the game.
Oh, really? That's like, I think it's because I instinctively went for the D-pad, so messing with it.
Right.
In fact, I've even since then, after like dying and I've like pushed the button and then realized I was on the D-pad, I'm like, wow, I really, really want to use the D-pad apparently, because I'm subconsciously just drawn to it.
Yeah, I basically stand by what I said last week, and that I like 2D Mario and 3D Mario better, but I enjoy that this mishmash exists just because there's not another Mario like it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'll agree to that with the addendum that there doesn't need to be another Mario game like it.
All right.
Now that it exists.
I do kind of wish that when they do another 3D Mario, that they just completely like realize, okay, some people just like 2D Mario and open it back up a bit.
I would actually
more.
Have much less problem with that, I think.
That seems like the logical thing to do is just make them side by side. There's no
Right. Make 2D Mario and 3D Mario, and you know, stop trying to make 3D Mario, you know, more and more linear, cuz as much as I absolutely love both Galaxy games, you know, like we talked about before, it's like they get, ever since Mario 64, the 3D games get less and less open and more and more structured like a 2D Mario.
That was actually what I was thinking too.
So the lines between the two are getting more and more blurred, and they're less and less of their own thing. So it would be kind of nice if they just kind of took a step back and be like, all right, let's just make a 2D Mario game completely for the 2D crowd, and 3D Mario game that doesn't try to get the 2D people to like the 3D Mario. We'll just go and embrace, you know, people who really like Mario 64 and just kind of go from there.
I think I would actually have preferred it to be more the Mario 64 style. And because I actually did like that out of all the 3D ones, you know, of course I played a ton of that when it came out. Like most people in the N64 era, because it's easily one of the best 3D platformers, I think. And definitely, I think, was the first 3D platformer to do it right, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
But I did kind of miss that exploration thing. I mean, and the jumping thing is, I think it's all on me. I don't think that's anyone else's problem, but.
You can't blame yourself, because there is a game out there that you do know how to do and that you like to do. And 20 other million people like to do it too, because that's how many sales it got. So. Mm. Yeah.
Are you trying to say that speed platforming in Mario 64 was easier? Because I kind of really agree with that.
I thought he was referring to playing 2D Mario.
Okay. Well, that's like a different thing.
Yeah,
obviously.
What's funny is, though, some of the levels I've been liking the best have been the ones that have done the extreme top-down thing, like where it's like either fully or almost fully top-down in this, because you really get a really good sense of the 3D effect in those ones, and because it's from that angle, I never miss jumps, because I can see exactly what's going on, which is weird, but I've actually, there's been a few that have been that way, and I've actually really liked those levels.
The only one I remember that fits that description is the Zelda one.
There's the Zelda one, and then there's been a couple where you get that crazy box with the propeller on it.
Oh, that's right.
And once
yeah.
you have that, it kind of turns it into that mode.
That's
and
true,
I actually really enjoy those parts.
Mm-hmm.
And those were some of the most fun I think I had with the game so far. And like I said, I'm not trying to totally crap on this game. I think it's a fun game. I'm just, you know, I just have a different preference, I guess. I don't know.
Well, I would think it's a fun game if it didn't make me so angry when I was playing it.
Fair enough.
I mean, I'm kind of one of those people that's like, you know, a game, I can't have a game that's fun 90% of the time and call it a good game, because if that other 10% is always going to come back up, that's always going to bother me.
Mm.
So you can't really call that a fun game. Gosh, there's so much more I wanted to say about this too. Actually, you know what, the one, my real snapping point, which I actually pulled the game, I feel bad about saying this, I pulled the game out of the machine and threw it, and I lost it for 2 hours.
That's pretty bad, so you really got mad at this game.
And I rarely ever do anything like that.
Sure
you do.
I've never been.
Wow, what part would have made you do that? Don't they give you the Tanuki Invincible suit at some point, or were you in the special stages?
Well, no, I never did. I only beat the game just today.
Mm.
I finally just powered my way through it. Oddly, I managed to do the whole last stage in a single run. I was kind of surprised about that. But no, it was the last airship stage, which, Jonah, I don't think you would have done, but
no,
Jesse, do you remember that?
You might have to refresh my memory, but sure.
Those airship stages are always auto-scrolling.
Yeah.
And this one had, like, all of the cylindrical rotating platforms.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I was just constantly unable to tell where Mario was going. And there's also, like, parts in the stage where, even though it's auto-scrolling, you can run off the screen. And, like I could run ahead of the camera for a good 5 seconds and not die, but, like, just run to a place where it would take 3 or 4 seconds for the camera to catch up to where I am. And, like, that shouldn't be a thing that happens in an auto-scrolling stage, ever.
Honestly, I mean, I think auto-scrolling stages probably just shouldn't happen anymore.
Not in a 3D game.
Nah. It's another one of those, like, let's use a 2D idea in the 3D Mario. And I think in that, like, I think there's a lot of cases that it worked, like, you know, them treating the power-ups more like actual power-ups. But then there's stuff like the scrolling thing. Yeah, I don't think that really works in 3D.
Yeah, well, even the treating it like power-ups this time, I don't think it worked that well because...
Really?
Well, okay, the Tanuki suit, it's obviously there as, like, a saving grace. It's there to make getting over the platforms easier.
Sure.
Because we already know there's a lot of trouble with the jumping.
Yeah.
And the fireball, it's, like, it's kind of slow, and now that it's in three directions, I'm not three directions, 360 degrees, like the fireball. All
right.
It's just not as it doesn't make you feel like as awesome as in a, like when a 2D Mario game.
Oh yeah, okay, I can see that.
But
sure.
at the same point, it's not like there's all these enemies around to like throw it at, because by definition of being a 3D Mario game, the enemy pacing is a lot kinder.
Yeah,
that's
definitely.
True.
What's funny about the Tanuki suit thing that I totally forgot that point was that it almost felt like they designed it to me. It was like, you're supposed to be using this Tanuki suit all the time, forever, in every level, in every situation. That's what it felt like to me because of the jumping being hard for me to predict where I was going to land.
I guess. I mean,
I don't know.
I've been playing all the special levels with Luigi, and I don't know. Like,
he jumps like a crazy drunk man.
He jumps like a crazy drunk man, and like still like... And some of these levels, like, you literally have 30 seconds to do them, or, well, then you can, like, you have to kill enemies to, like, get an extra 10 seconds and whatnot. Like, some of those special world ones are, like, super speedrun focused and whatnot, and I thought it felt fine.
I can only speak to the first five worlds, because I just got to world six then.
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe that's they're trying to ease you into it, what I've played so far.
Right.
It could be, because actually that's about as far as I got on my very first run through, like to the fourth or fifth world. And to that point, I wasn't really being so aggravated with it. It really wasn't until world six that I felt like it started to push the pins and make the jumping inaccurate. Go ahead.
See, now for me, like, my biggest problem with it going in was that, like, I felt like the game didn't challenge you enough. And then, like, once I got to the special worlds, I felt like the game kind of fixed itself. But it sounds like you would probably enjoy the special worlds even less, given that you are not enjoying the accuracy of the jumping.
I'm doubting it. I did play a couple of the special world stages just to mess around with them and see what they were like. But it wasn't much. Like, I didn't have a problem with it, because it was just, there was nothing, I did the castle stage, which was basically a speed run, but it wasn't too difficult, and I did the very first stage because I wanted to test out Luigi.
Right.
Are they all the crazy time thing? Because I only went into a couple. Okay.
There's
things
only
where, like, they do the Mario copies that follow you.
Yeah,
they're completely different, aren't they?
Sometimes they have, like, most of the time they have no strict time limit and no Mario chasing you. Those are just some of the things that they do sometimes.
Okay, I just happened to grab, like, two in a row then at random that were timed, and one of which had the little creepy thing following you.
Yeah, and the funny thing about those ones is that since he mimics your movements, you're actually not really rushed, you just think you are.
Yeah, that's what I noticed. Like, at first I was like, is he running slightly faster than me? And then I'm like, well, wait a minute, he can never actually catch up unless I stop moving.
Yeah.
So it kind of, like, it was kind of tripping me out at first, but I think it's all just to give you that sense of you got to keep moving.
Right, because there's basically the two kinds of speedrun levels, and the Mario copy ones aren't really speedrun mandatory, speedrun type levels, because can just trick the path that he does and spend as much time as you want on a section.
Yeah,
whereas the other ones, you actually have the 30 seconds, and then you have to either collect clocks or kill other enemies to get the extra 10 seconds.
One of the ones I happened to pick had him chasing, and it had the 30 second timer going. So,
oh yeah, they occasionally do both at the same time, but not always.
Okay, so I just happened to get one of the ones that was like extra hard.
Either of those things.
Sure.
Most of the levels, in fact, I would say, are just like standard, time limit, no Mario chasing you. It's just that they have rearranged a lot of platforms to make a much harder level than would be in the standard game. And even a lot of the special worlds are not particularly difficult, but some of the later ones did get to a point where I died quite a few times. But sometimes it's because they put those coins in, like, sometimes the levels themselves wouldn't be that hard, but the three coins that you collect make them a lot harder.
Hmm.
You know, the ones that I'm talking about?
Yeah. I think I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Just to make it real quick, since I don't think we want to spend too much time on this, other things that bothered me about the game. I didn't like how there was no coherency with the worlds.
There's no theme.
I was actually excited when I first got to the second world. I'm like, it's not a desert stage. This is, wow, what's going on?
You know what? I did the exact same thing.
But in that second world, there's a desert stage, a beach stage, and a snow stage.
Yeah, there's no theme at all in this.
No, it's so bizarre. And then actually you get to the eighth world, and that's supposed to be like the dark, that's always the dark lava cave.
Yeah,
kind of
yeah.
And the first stage you play follows that theme, and then the next stage you play is like total cheery grasslands Mario with
yeah,
the
that was
cheery
nuts.
Music.
You're in Bowser's garden.
Yeah, it just really takes you out of it.
Through my stress. my Zen garden.
He's got those sand things with the rakes everywhere.
as much as I did hate like the jumping and the really just having a hard time telling where Mario was in relation to the ground and falling off cliffs a bunch without realizing it, what actually made me what I hated more was not understanding.
Go on.
Was not understanding what happened, but somehow making it.
Getting
through some weird obstacle, like, without feeling like I did it, and just be like, what just happened?
Yeah, I get what you're saying.
And then, And then I don't like that Mario farts.
What?
What?
When, all right, so when you run, like, you don't actually run right away. You kind of go, you don't have a smooth acceleration, but you kind of just, you'll be moving forward when you run. And then Mario farts, and then you start running.
Huh, all right.
Like, it'll make like a sound, and a cloud comes up. Go and play it. You'll see what I mean.
I didn't realize we were playing the Lou Albano version of Mario.
If you zoom in, you can see his stained pants.
Oh, I didn't need that image. But it's actually, it is actually annoying in the sense that there's this weird period for Mario to actually start speeding up that sometimes, like when you want to jump off of a narrow platform with speed, it feels like it's almost impossible to do. Like, I'll feel like I'm taking a running leap and then jump, and his horizontal motion will be like an inch an hour. He'll practically jump straight up, and I'm trying to, you know, jump over some kind of chasm, and that's not going to work.
Yeah, that happened to me a lot.
Yeah. But no, he definitely watched for the Mario fart. That's a real thing.
Didn't Mario Fart 7 just come out today?
Oh. Well done.
That's what I'm here for. All right, are we done complaining about Mario?
Yes, this will definitely be a return. I took the time to register this game just so I could tell Nintendo what I thought of it.
Wow.
All right.
Did we make you sad, Jesse?
That's the thing, though. It's like, I enjoy Mario 3D Land, but it's not as good as a 2D or a 3D Mario. Okay. Like, yeah. I accept that.
Okay.
And I already said it last
yeah,
week.
Yeah, I know.
So.
I was going to say, it's not like, I don't know, I've just seen such positive reviews to the point where now that I've played it, I'm like, it's not like a terrible game, but really? Like,
yeah, exactly. And it's like, when Mario Galaxy 2 came out, like, that was one of my favorite games of that year.
Right.
This is not one of my favorite games of this year.
Okay,
and like,
fair
I
enough.
Still I still enjoy it. I think, you know, like I played it a whole, you know, I played most of it in one night, partly because it's short, but partly because I was having a good time.
Sure.
But yeah, I don't think it's nearly as strong as the pure 2D or the pure 3D Mario.
And I haven't gotten to a point where I've stopped having fun. I will say that.
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
Even with the frustration parts, which has only happened a few times so far, but I'm not on the hard levels yet, so we'll see how that goes.
There's a difference in frustration between it feeling like it's your fault and it not feeling like it's
your fault. That's true. Yeah, definitely.
And I'm not a person who necessarily thinks I'm great at games. Like, there are games that I completely suck at, but I do still enjoy playing them because I can feel my inadequacy, but also my, like, the hope I can get better. I feel like I can understand the mechanics of it and actually get better at it.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this game, I just don't, I can't feel like I know what's going on. It just doesn't, it's hard to explain.
I get what you're saying.
When you play like a Super Mario Brothers or a Mega Man or something, there's definitely, I've tried to explain this before, but there's definitely just a kinetic, solid feel to it that, like, you can predict what's going to happen. Like, I think that's where I got the meat sense from in Super Meat Boy. Like, the controls are so tuned, you can feel what's going to happen, and I love that feeling. Okay.
Well, that's fair.
Next game!
All right. Well, I played Ticket to Ride on the iPhone because it's a board game I want, and those kind of board games are usually pretty expensive. And I was like, hey, I can try it for $1 by getting the iPhone version. And now I want the board game. basically, it's a pretty simple mechanic. There's some sort of plot involving, you know, people trying to ride the longest, like, distance on trains, because it's set in the time when that would be a thing. But it's a board game, so having a plot doesn't really matter. At least not for this type of board game. So essentially, at the start of the game, you get dealt three cards, and each of them is a route, like, from one city to another. So say it's, you know, Seattle to Los Angeles. That would be a pretty short train route. Sometimes you'll get ones that are really long that you have to cross, like, the entire country, you know, to connect the two cities. And then the map, which is the board, you know, has the United States, and it has all the different routes, and they have all these different, how many cars, like train cars, it takes to connect the, like, two of the cities in between. So eventually you have to connect, like, little tiny chunks of tracks to eventually connect up the two cities. And you basically, it's just a simple matter of on your turn, you can either pick two cards that like there's like five, I think, or six that are face up, or you can pick like the ones off the top of the deck until you have enough of the correct color to, you know, start connecting those train routes. And, you know, there's a lot of strategy in trying to, if you can kind of predict where your opponents are trying to connect, you can just be a jerk and like take, you know, occupy those. But you only have so many train cars as well. So basically the game ends when the first person runs out of cars to spend on putting down. So it's a very simple like game in general, like to actually learn how to play the mechanics, but there's actually quite a bit of strategy to it, because at the end of the game, when it ends, you get a last turn warning when someone is down to their last car, train car to connect. And any routes you haven't fully connected get subtracted from your total score at the end. So you get points every time you put down and claim like any train route, and then you get however many points were listed on that card. And of course, the longer the route, the more it's worth. So sometimes, you know, there's more, sometimes there's strategy in taking a whole bunch of ones that only, you know, have a few, you know, closer cities to connect. Sometimes you'll, cause you get dealt the three, but you don't have to take all three. You can claim any one, two, or three of them, to start connecting up. And then if you want to take more cards on during the course of the game, you can choose to do that. But of course, it's going to be harder the farther into the game it is to actually complete them. And if you don't, then all those points are going to get subtracted from your total at the end. So it's a lot of, you know, risk and reward about how you can connect up all these things. And then if you can, whoever has the longest connected route between everything at the end of the game gets extra points too. So it's sometimes beneficial to purposely, when you have the choice of the three cards, picking ones that kind of connect up so you can make a super long route. So it's like, it sounds like a lot when I'm trying to explain, you know, the workings of a board game, because board games are all about mechanics, you know?
Right.
So unless it's right in front of you, it kind of gets confusing to just be told the rules of a game, but
even when it is right in front of
you. And sometimes even when it is right in front of you, usually the best thing, what I've found is the best way to get other people that I know to play board games with me is I learn how to play the game and then I show them how to play the game and then we play around. And then by the end of the round, they're like, oh, okay, now it's making sense.
Yeah, pretty much.
And I've even had some friends who have bought games and just handed me the rule book and were like, here, learn how to play this and then we'll play it. So I've somehow become the rules guy for board games, but that's all right. I have fun figuring them out. But anyway, it's one of those where it seems pretty complicated at first, but actually what I was going to say, the reason why I wanted to even talk about it being a board game and all was if you're interested in it, get the iPhone version, because for $1 it basically teaches you all the ins and outs and the strategy right there. And
right,
it's a really fun version. The only thing it's really missing is an online like versus mode or something, because
you have to play against the computer.
There is local like multiplayer on there, so you could pass the iPhone back and forth. And then I guess there is some games apparently have where you can play on multiple iPhones and they can connect up like locally.
I've seen that.
And this has that, but I was reading some of the reviews saying that mode was kind of broken, like it was kind of unstable. And unfortunately, if your game drops, you lose like that entire game.
Yeah, that would suck.
So you're better off just playing the pass version, it sounds like.
Right.
There's
not any like hidden parts or anything. Like, can't see my cards.
The only thing that would be hidden was you wouldn't really want them to know which trains you're trying to, or which cities you're trying to connect up.
Okay. Because I know like there have been certain games like that, like Advance Wars, they always had an optional like hot seats multiplayer mode, but like
doesn't have like a tap when you're ready.
Sorry, what?
Like, I think a lot of games that do that have a screen that'll blank it and be like,
yeah,
tap when
exactly.
You're ready.
Because, like, if you were playing Fog of War with that enabled on Advance War games, you're like, oh, I handed you the thing, and now you see where all my guys are.
Yeah.
Might as well not have Fog.
Exactly.
but yeah, no, usually games like that will have some sort of now hand it to the other player screen so that you don't do that.
Exactly. And I assume it does. I haven't tried that mode yet, but it really has made me want to buy the full game, which I think is about a $40 board game, which for one of these games is actually pretty reasonable. I mean, I've seen ones anywhere from you know, 30 to 100, depending on the game, depending on how many pieces the game has.
Yeah.
Like, there's this one that I've seen, the box has to weigh like 25 pounds. It's ridiculous. It's basically like everything that you would do in a pen and paper RPG, except that there's an actual like little figurine to represent it. So like all the monsters and dudes, like the guys you play as, and all there's cards and tokens for all the equipment and money and all this stuff. So it's like, don't use your imagination, use all these crazy figures. It's really strange, but those ones are always ridiculously expensive. But yeah, this one is simple enough once you get going that I think it's got a pretty wide appeal to people that are interested in board gaming at all, which is a thing that I enjoy quite a bit. That's why I bring it up.
Do you mean more board gaming like Monopoly, or do you mean like tabletop RPGs?
I mean, like, kind of in between that, where that's kind of where a lot of these games that I play are at. They're kind of the middle ground. They're not super complicated like an RPG, but they're fun, unlike Monopoly.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the problem when you say, I play board games, and people are like, you mean like Monopoly and Clue and stuff? And I'm like, well, Clue's all right, but check this out.
Yeah.
There's a guy who does like videos about his experiences with like tabletop RPGs, and it's really entertaining.
That
and
sounds actually, like something I would enjoy.
I think you would enjoy it quite a bit, actually. And I don't know if I fancy myself like a tabletop RPG player, but I can't help but be a little intrigued by it after seeing these videos.
Yeah. They're always so cool looking.
Yes. I've never played one that was the actual like one where you have a persistent character and go on adventures. I have played a lot of the Star Wars, the minifigure game, which was actually, it used the same character sets and rule sets as the RPG, but it was all just the action sequences.
Dude,
it was basically, did you play that one with me at all,
Jesse? I played it a few times. Okay. It was okay. The coolest one was that MechWarrior one, but it was so freaking complicated.
Yeah, see, that one was,
but it was so good.
Was an extra level of complication to
it was,
what
it
the
was
one
like
that I was
one step away from the, you know, like crazy, like Warhammer style super complicated. It was like not quite there, but almost, because you're like building maps by like stacking all these DVD cases everywhere and like getting out a tape measure to see like if you're, you know, aiming is, you know, going to be able to hit that far. And, you know, it was, there's the heat dials on your mechs. It was pretty complicated. But
yeah,
it was,
that one was pretty intense.
It was a lot of fun, though. The few times that I actually got somebody who was willing to learn it, it was pretty fun.
So, yeah, that's good stuff. But the problem with a lot of those is they're very expensive. The ones that have continuing collectibles like that get very expensive. But that's why I like these ones like this game, where it's just you buy it and you're done. Or if you want to, there's sometimes expansion packs. Like even Carcassonne at this point has like a billion different expansions you can buy for it.
Mm-hmm.
But from what little I've played of some of the other ones, I kind of prefer the base game.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's that. I would recommend checking out Ticket to Ride if you have a way to play it. I believe it's also on XBLA and probably PSN. I know I downloaded the demo on XBLA with the intention of learning it forever ago, and I just kind of forgot that I had it on there.
Right.
So yeah, I guess Jesse, back to you.
You know, you haven't played any more Zelda, have you?
No, I have not.
I'm thinking maybe I'll just like skip a week of Zelda talk until you've gotten to play more of it, so that's not just me again.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so anyway, I'm playing Mario Kart 7 right now.
Yeah.
And it's pretty fun. I like that. The track design seems... the blue shells are still there, unfortunately. I wish they'd just like realize that nobody actually likes those and get rid of them. Because, like, you know, the whole weapons-based racer thing is fine. Like, sure, I generally prefer racing games that don't have weapons, but Mario Kart is kind of, you know, that's part of what Mario Kart is, so it's fine in that context.
Sure.
But, I mean, who really likes blue shells, honestly?
Yeah, who does?
Because everybody's like, oh, I love Mario Kart, except for those blue shells.
I know. It's like they feel obligated because it's in there now or something.
I don't know what the deal is, but anyway, so yeah, those are still in there. That's what it is, but the tracks seem pretty cool. That's one thing about, like, you know, the Mario Karts is sometimes you get one that's like the DS one where the tracks are amazing, and sometimes you get one with the game, like, that's like the GameCube one, the tracks are kind of meh.
Did you like the actual race mechanic in that one, real quick? I was curious.
In the GameCube one, it was
interesting. I liked it. I mean, it was fun if you had a second person. If you didn't,
yeah. It seemed pointless. If
you didn't, it seemed pointless and kind of cumbersome. But it was cool if you had somebody. And I did. I actually, the only reason I enjoyed the GameCube one as much as I did is because I went through the entire thing with a friend.
Yeah.
Because that was the one where you had two people per cart.
Right.
And anyway, but yeah, this 3DS one, Mario Kart 7, which for some reason is not called Mario Kart 3DS, which you'd think it would be. I have enjoyed the track design quite a bit. In fact, there are three different tracks that are not lap-based, that are instead one giant track that you have a start and a finish.
Huh, nice.
And I really like that. Like, I never thought I'd say this, but I'm like, oh man, this Woohoo Island track is really awesome. It's like, that is not something I thought I would say. They really love using that whole Woohoo Island stuff for, like, pilot lanes and whatnot.
I thought they were so clever with that.
I know. But they did a really good job of using it in Mario Kart 7, I think. And, you know, part of it is because it's not lap-based. So it's just this super long track. So, you know, it has three times as much content as a normal Mario Kart track would have. And there are three different tracks that do that. And one of them is the final track, Rainbow Road, the new version of Rainbow Road.
Oh, wow.
Which is pretty rad. I like the new version of Rainbow Road quite a bit.
Is it still like 10 hours long? Or?
Well, you're only doing one lap, though. So it's about as long as a normal Mario Kart track. It's just that it's all, you know, new all the time instead of you doing it three times.
Okay.
But what's cool about it is, like, you know, obviously it has the standard, like, there's, you know, the parts with no railing and rainbowy looking road, of course. But there's also, like, parts where you're, like, driving on Saturn's rings and parts where you, like, go on the moon and the gravity changes for that specific part.
Okay.
So it's like it's a really cool track. I enjoyed it quite a bit. And then, you know, I think, Adam, you've got to play a little bit of Mario Kart on, like, show floor demo, right?
Yeah. It felt like regular old Mario Kart. It was good.
Yeah, pretty much. I don't know how you felt about the flying. I've actually been really enjoying the flying a lot more than I thought I would be.
I didn't feel like it added a whole lot, although it was actually more interesting than the underwater parts, which didn't feel like anything different.
Yeah, the underwater parts, I mean, they feel a little different, but not enough to really matter all that much. But the flying, I feel like there, you get like a lot of speed when you do it most of the time. So like it feels kind of like exhilarating in a way, like you can actually kind of get ahead of people while you're in the air, like up ahead of people that are on the ground and you know, flying over obstacles and stuff. And I thought that was actually a pretty sweet addition, a lot more so than I thought I would.
I don't think I played it enough to realize what kind of difference it made in the actual race. Although it did, for the most part, I just realized like you had to land it right or you would spin out.
Really?
I was pretty sure I crashed a couple of times because I like hit the edge too hard or something.
Weird. I've never had that happen. I don't know if it's because they removed it or if it's just because it's never happened to me.
I couldn't tell you. I mean,
yeah, that's never been a thing for me.
You know, obviously because it's Mario Kart, I kind of want to get it. But the truth of the matter is, like, now that I'm in this apartment complex now with these other people, it's so much more convenient to play Mario Kart Wii because we can all play it.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
But
like,
I think
no one else here has a 3DS. So.
Yeah, okay. But if you got the version, you know, we could probably play it online. The thing is, though, is that the time difference is so crazy that you kind of have to like schedule it out or something.
Figure something out.
But back on the like game mechanics and whatnot, one of the other things I really like, you know, that we've known for a while is how they added the coins back in.
Oh yeah.
So like basically you can only hold 10 coins at a time, and basically what it does is every coin you get gives you a tiny, tiny speed boost immediately and also increases your top speed. And if you get hit, you'll lose, it seems like 1 to 3 coins, depending on how badly you were hit, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
But because those coins are there, it kind of, it kind of gives you these little extra goals, much like the item boxes did, that are just kind of incentivizing, you know, going to different areas of the track and, you know, whatnot. And it also acts actually as your as the way you unlock things. So the more coins that you're getting while you're racing, like, the faster you'll be unlocking things in the game. So there's just kind of like this, you know, dual incentive there for, you know, getting these coins. And I think it works really well. Like, I enjoy that they're there. They make the race just an extra little extra layer to it that makes it more interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Have they only been in that first one?
You know, I think they might have been in the GBA one, too. But, you know, I really didn't play the GBA one much. That's my least played Mario Kart by far.
I don't think I've ever played it, either.
I think I played it, like, really briefly somewhere, but I don't recall. All the other Mario Karts I've played the crap out of, but that one, just, I don't think I had a GBA when it came out.
I'm wondering if it was a Gamer Time, one of their challenge things or something.
I think it might have been.
Because I do vaguely remember playing it one time. That might have been why.
Yeah. But yeah, like another one, speaking back on the track design, like the one I'm racing right now, for example, is kind of based on Mario 1. So they have, like, you know, the kind of grassland areas with all the blocks and the castles, and then you go down, and then it's the underground, you know, where everything's kind of blue, and there's tubes with the piranha plants and whatnot. But, like, I mean, they've done, like, kind of similar things, but they never really went as heavy into that Mario 1 aesthetic as they have in this particular level that I'm on right now. It's just kind of like a nice little nostalgia trip. They also have a Mario 2 level, which I know you'll enjoy.
Oh, yeah. I remember hearing about that. Everyone was excited that it acknowledges that that exists because Nintendo doesn't like to acknowledge it.
And instead of just being like, you know, the first level of Mario 2 or something, they actually did something a little different. They went with the desert. So it's like a nighttime desert level, and it has like all the vase, you know, the vases or however you like to say that, and it's got the little like guys on magic carpets and whatnot.
Doesn't it have the Pokies?
I don't recall. But, you know, it's a nice little nod to that game, which, as you said, they don't like to make nods to that game, it seems like.
No.
Very often.
It's the only other one is, the Mario Kart DS had the Shy Guy, if you didn't have a cartridge.
If you didn't have a cartridge, it had the Shy Guy, which I'll have to check if this one has the download play with, like, limited features, because I'm actually not sure. I did try the online a bit, though, and it was kind of cool because, aside from the community creation, which I haven't dabbled too heavily in yet, it like, when you're waiting for a match, it will actually go into spectator mode, and you'll be watching people race in real time, but it'll be doing it from, like, replay cams to keep it actually interesting. So that's kind of cool. Just, you know, a little neat addition. The community stuff you can kind of set. That's the one where you, like, you know, you create a code for people to add, and then they'll be in that community. They only have to enter the code once, and then they're in a community with a bunch of different people. And you can set some custom rules for it. Like, aside from the speed class, you can actually limit item types, but not to the extent as, like, a Smash Brothers. Like, you can't individually toggle every single item, but you can do different things, like, you know, no items, obviously, or you can do, like, mushrooms only, or bananas only, or shells only, but unfortunately, I imagine that would include the blue shell.
Yeah.
Because what I wish you could do is just say, all items except for blue shell, but unfortunately...
Which is what everyone wanted to do, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't hate the other items. That's the only one. I mean, Bill was kind of lame, but not to the point where I'm like, this shouldn't be in here.
Right. It's frustrating that that isn't one of the options, but it's still nice that they give you, like, those other options.
Yeah, because green shells especially seem fair.
Those actually take some skill to use.
When I bean someone with one of those, I'm like, man, I'm awesome, because it's really hard to hit people with those stupid things.
Yeah, I used to pride myself in my green shell usage on Mario Kart 64.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, obviously the game is very much still Mario Kart. You're going to have a lot of the same frustration especially with those blue shells. While talking, I had a match where I exploded over the finish line from a blue shell. Nice. I lucked out by being, you know, just a second hitting me like a second earlier would have totally screwed me over. So you're still going to run into all those same problems, but, you know, it at least has good track design, some cool things that they're doing with online, because really, I mean, Mario Kart's all about the multiplayer, so that's That's kind of a must.
That's pretty much how we've played every single one of them. So.
Right, right. But yeah, I mean, it's like, if you like Mario Kart at all, this from what I played so far tonight, it seems like one of the good ones. I mean, even the DS one, which I had considered to be the best one, still had the blue shell.
Yeah, that's true.
And unfortunately, it ain't going away.
Doesn't seem that way. All right.
And then I have one other very, very small one.
Okay.
I didn't know if anybody else had anything, though.
No, not unless we're doing our Let's Play Together.
Okay. So, yeah, the other small thing I booted up is the DLC for Jamestown Legend of the Lost Colony came out. I'm actually not 100% sure when exactly it came out. It was fairly recently, I think. But it ended up not being any new levels, but if anybody forgot, this is that that shmup that's on 17th century British colonial Mars.
Mm-hmm, of course.
It actually turned out to be really good.
Yeah.
And so I just kind of wanted to buy the DLC just because I really wanted to support this game. This is just made by, like, I think it was mostly made by, like, two guys, but you would never know from playing it. Like, it looks and plays as good as a lot of shmups made by, like, normal developers.
Like, actual big teams and stuff.
Right, right. Like, they did a really good job of it.
Yeah.
But anyway, this DLC came out, and it's basically three new ships. There are four in the original game, and they actually all played, like, drastically different, and these three pretty much do as well. Like, one of the ships has, like, three grenades that circle it, and you can shoot the, like, you have your normal, like, standard, like, pea shooter type thing that's always shooting ahead, but you hit the special weapon button, it'll, like, fire one of these three circling grenades out, and then those kind of take a bit to, you know, recharge themselves. Like, if you're to use all three, you'll have nothing for a bit until they come back. And it's like, that one feels like the least unique in that there's already a ship that has kind of a charge mechanic to it, but it still feels different enough to be interesting. The other two ships, though, feel actually quite a bit different. One of them is it's kind of got like a homing shot as a secondary fire, but it can't fire very fast. And then it has like, if you hold down the special button, you can make like more powerful missiles, but it will totally like impede your movement speed while you're charging. So there's kind of like an interesting back and forth between that ship, and then the final ship is like, you can make like a ghost copy of yourself, and that will fire like both forwards and backwards. But then your gun on like your ship that you're actually controlling is like really weak. So that one's like kind of weird to use, because it almost seems like the ghost copy is more powerful than you are. I don't know if that's actually true, but that's certainly what it seemed like.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, just like, I really like how in that game, you know, even in the standard version, like all those ships just really feel really different. And when I took that Portland trip recently, me and a buddy, I had him buy the game, because he really likes shmups too. And we went through the whole game again, and we had a great fun playing co-op, which it's a real shame that that doesn't have online. It's a PC game that's local only. That's so weird.
Yeah, that is probably because of the team being small.
Yeah. I mean, you got to hand it to the indie team for, you know, making such a solid game in the first place. But another reason I kind of wanted to bring the game up is because now that the DLC is out, you can actually get a bundle that includes, on Steam, you can get a bundle that includes the full game, the DLC, and the soundtrack, which is really good and kind of unconventional for a shmup in the style that it is, for $15. So
yeah, that's really cool.
Like, I think I probably played, like, it's probably cheaper now, but I probably paid like $10 just to get the game, and like didn't regret any second of it. So yeah, like for $15, getting that game, that really awesome shmup, that it's DLC and the soundtrack. If you like shmups at all, you should definitely be getting in on this, because that's a really cool game. Jamestown, the Lost Colony, if you didn't catch it the first time.
Yeah, so basically, I'm just looking at the package right now. The base game is still only $10 if you really just want to get that. But basically, if you buy the package, you're essentially getting the DLC part for free, because it's saving you like $3, and that's the DLC price. So.
Right.
So there you go. Cool. All right, well, let's get into our Let's Play Together segment. Almost almost bumped it back again because it's getting late. But
that would be
couldn't.
What, the fourth time or something?
Well, you've been wanting to do this forever.
Well, okay, so Jesse and I have been playing Battlefield 3, and we've been playing it off and on. I think you've been playing it more
for sure.
Than I have.
For sure.
But we got in a couple good play sessions recently. And I am having a lot of fun with this, and I am not a big fan of the military first-person shooters in general.
Well, to be fair, though, I mean, we used to play Battlefield 1942 quite a bit.
That was
always kind of an exception.
Exactly, yeah. The Battlefield games, just, I don't know what it is about them. They just seem to have a different feel to me.
I do. It's the way that the rules work.
I guess so.
For me, anyway.
Yeah.
Like, okay, and here's a perfect example of why I think this is one of the key things. We accidentally played Team Deathmatch one time, and it was really lame.
Okay.
On
was
Battlefield
that just standard 3. However many kills people get type
yeah,
of thing?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
it was like,
okay.
It was like, oh, now it's a normal first-person shooter. I don't like
it
anymore.
So,
but when we play Conquest mode, then it's like, you know, how we used to play Battlefield 1942, where it's all about capturing bases and, you know, doing all these cool things and, you know, using your vehicles and whatnot to cover lots of ground to, you know, get to certain bases and defend them, and that's what makes Battlefield great.
Right. So essentially, if you've never played a game in any of the Battlefield series, the thing that they do, in this one it's called Conquest mode, but in the old ones I think it was like the mode that existed, right?
Pretty sure Battlefield 1942 was just that mode and nothing else.
So essentially both teams have a certain number of tickets, they call them, which are just like, you know, it starts at what, 250 or 300 depending on the map.
Yeah, I think it varies
and
from map to map.
There's different bases along the map and you occupy them and you have to be in that, like, within a certain vicinity of the center point, which is a flagpole, and then your team will capture it. And the more bases you have, the faster the other team's tickets are counting down. So once they reach zero, whoever reaches zero first loses, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And they also lose tickets if you lose tickets for your team if you die. But it doesn't totally destroy your team's progress by dying a few times, which I think is one of the reasons I really like these games, is because you can run out if your playstyle is to be, you know, like a berserker essentially and try and like rush guys and shoot them. You're not going to last very long, but you might make a good distraction while your team picks off a few guys, and lose, you know, dying a few times does not totally screw over your team, which in Team Deathmatch it does, because that's all about kill count.
Right.
And I think that's one of the things I really like about these games, is it actually kind of, it really rewards teamwork in capturing the bases, because if you have more people in the base, it'll capture it faster.
I also really like the class-based nature of
it.
And the,
definitely.
And the, you know, persistent character progression and all that. Because, like, you know, for example, I almost exclusively play as an assault, which doubles as a medic, and you almost exclusively play as an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, our other buddy, he almost exclusively plays as a recon, which is essentially a sniper. And so it's like, you know, you're in these mini squads of four people as part of a larger team of, like, what, 16, 12, whatever it is?
It's 12 in this one.
And, you know, so you have this whole, like, team mentality where, like, you know, if somebody dies and part of the squad, part of the four-man squad is still alive, you can spawn on them.
Yeah,
so you can
awesome.
So you can stick together.
Because some of these maps are ridiculously big.
Right. So because you can stick together, you know, as this, like, sub-unit of a larger team, you can kind of complement each other's abilities. Like, you know, if somebody dies as an assault, I have the defibrillators and I can actually bring them back. But then, you know, if a vehicle comes, I'm not particularly effective, but Jonah can whip out either his rocket launcher or lay down a bunch of mines, and, you know, we can take out a tank. Or, you know, our other buddy can see a guy in the distance and be able to snipe him. It's like, because we all, you know, enjoy playing a different class, we, you know, we're a pretty well-balanced team.
That has worked out very well for the three of us.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the other thing is when you have, you can spawn if you die from the bases that you have captured as well. So it benefits you to have more of them in that regard as well. And of course, you know, they can get retaken over. That's a big part of it is, okay, there's a lot of times a good match that's really exciting is usually a really big back and forth between people capturing and recapturing.
Some of those have been pretty surprising, like matches that, well, we've been on both sides of it, matches that we either thought there's no way we can lose this or there's no way we can come back from this. It has happened.
Yeah, yeah. And there's been some crazy things, like when I, because you have to unlock a lot of the stuff, like you have your class and he starts pretty bare bones. But like the mines, I had to unlock those. The nice thing is you get experience from pretty much everything, which is nice. Like helping, like a kill assist, you get experience, you get assist for, or, you know, you get Jesse when he revives guys, he's getting some experience. Like if your squad mates spawn on you, you get experience.
It encourages you to do your job well.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Like if, like you said, if I heal a guy, I get just as much experience as if I were to kill a guy.
Yeah.
So it's like I am very motivated to, you know, not go lone wolf and like actually be like, oh, my buddies are dead, I need to go heal them, because that's like really, not only does it help me that they will then be alive, but it also helps me to level up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've had times where there's a road leading towards our base, and well, this one time I laid down my mines and I take another couple steps and there's this giant explosion. I'm like, what the heck? I turn around and there's a tank. An enemy tank was trying to actively run me over, and they ran over my mines and it destroyed the tank and all the guys in it, gave me a bunch of experience.
There are all kinds of hilarious immersion gameplay like type moments where, like one time when it was just me and our other buddy playing, we were on this bridge. And, like, you know, he'd die and I'd heal him and then I'd die and then he'd steal my defibrillators off my corpse and revive me with them. Like, you can do crazy stuff like that. And then he actually at one point switched to an assault so that we both had defibrillators, and we were holding this bridge and just, we always had to make sure one of us was alive, and we just kept reviving the other person. And we were able to hold
so much experience.
Oh yeah. And we were able to hold this bridge like just almost forever.
Yeah.
Until finally the enemy got both of us killed at once. But
yeah.
But yeah, it's just funny moments like that can happen all the time.
And the other thing the engineer can do is, like, the only thing that is kind of crazy is you only have so many slots, and certain types of things fill that slot. So you have your main gun, you have a pistol, and then you kind of have your special thing, which, like, of course, is the rocket launcher for mine. Mm. And then I can either have the mines or a repair kit, and the repair kit allows me to repair vehicles or damage enemy vehicles. And so oftentimes what I'll see other teams doing, of course, is they'll have an engineer in a tank with someone else driving it so he can keep hopping out and healing it.
Right.
So I've actually had times where, because usually that first rocket just disables the tank.
Mm-hmm.
So if I've had times where I've disabled the tank, I see their dude like hop out to repair it. So I'll run up and put mines all around it. So they'll repair it, get back in, and the second they start driving, they blow up.
Yeah, that is such a satisfying thing.
And I laugh every time. It's like, did their engineer not see me laying? Because I think as engineers, you can pick up, because you can pick up your own mines.
Yeah,
I think you can disable the other mines.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you can disable
them. And I have not seen anyone do that. Every time I do that, it works, which is really funny to me.
To be fair, those mines are hard to see.
They are. I mean, that is kind of what they're there for, but
right.
There is just so much to the game, and it's probably the most fun I've had playing multiplayer in a shooter, like,
Battlefield 1942.
Probably since Battlefield 1942. I was going to say maybe Rainbow Six Vegas 2, but I think I'm liking this better now that we're getting into it.
Oh, yeah. I definitely, now that we're, like, you know, really into the character progression and stuff and whatnot, I definitely am liking it better than our time with Rainbow Six Vegas.
Yeah. It doesn't have a, like, cover cling to button, but I actually got used to that pretty fast.
I think the, you know, being able to go prone and lay on the ground is,
yeah.
I mean, that's something that you can't do in that other game. So
that's,
you know,
true. Yeah, I forgot all about that.
It kind of balances
that
out in a way.
And you know what's funny is the camouflage actually worked well enough that I was just kind of goofing around and I did the laying down, and it was like this alley, but there was like a tree, because it has that Frostbite 2 thing where a lot of stuff's destructible.
Right.
So someone had knocked over a tree and I was basically basically hiding in a fallen tree, like in the branches, a guy ran right past me and like totally didn't see me. And I was like, oh man, maybe he just wasn't paying attention. So I, you know, if you run up behind them, you can knife them and you get like their dog tags and you get a bunch of experience. Well, later I was going down that alley and they had like two guys hiding in that tree and I didn't even see them until they were shooting at me. I'm like, man, the camo actually works in this game. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. I think one of the things that really hooks me into it, like you were saying earlier, kind of, that the leveling system, like, it almost has kind of a Disgaea-like hook in that, like you were saying, everything levels. So you have a player rank where it's just like your overall experience from just playing the game. Then you have the class experience where it's experience specific to that class. And then you have the weapon experience where it's the more you use that particular weapon, the more, like, attachments you'll get to, like, put on it. And so it's like, that kind of constant rewarding system, like, you know, I mean, it's not the only game to have a system like this, but the one it does have works very well.
Yeah, it works well, and even, like, yeah, the vehicles get perks.
Oh, yeah, you know? even the vehicles get perks, that's true.
Yeah, so, like, now that I've done enough, I barely use the vehicles because I'm terrible at them, but I've started trying to use the tanks a little bit, and I've gotten enough where I can, like, hit this button and, like, this giant smoke cloud will come out, and I've seen other people do it, and I didn't know what was going on. I'm like, man, there's crazy random effects going on, but it wasn't random. It was like it makes it hard as an engineer to know where to shoot for the tank.
Right.
Because the cloud is, like, three times the size of the tank.
The only thing that sucks is when, this is actually kind of the boat I'm in right now. I was using this one gun for so long. I have so many awesome attachments for it. And then I unlocked a new gun that's better. But I have, so like, have no attachments for it. So it's like I don't have any cool scope. Well, I have like one scope, which is like kind of crappy. And, you know, the other one I had like holographic reticles and like infrared scopes and just all kinds of crazy crap. And it's like, now I got like none of that, but I have a gun that's way more powerful.
It doesn't make you want to keep playing though.
Oh yeah, that's what I'm getting. It totally hooks you. But yeah, back on the Frostbite Engine stuff, it's really cool, you know, how you're like, oh, this guy is sniping me from the building, so I'm going to, like, blow a crater into this building. That's always satisfying.
It's pretty awesome. Like, because there's been a couple levels where I'm like, oh, I'm the engineer, and there's not really much to do with this rocket launcher, and then I find out I can, like, blow up their barricades and stuff with the rockets, and then I'm back in the game.
like that Metro level, specifically. There's the part, like, before you get into the subway tunnels that has those buildings that everybody's, you know, like people would use to snipe you and sometimes even pin you down if your team is doing really poor. But yeah, like you could just totally blow up giant gaping holes in these buildings. Yeah. And then, you know, it's like they can still use them to snipe, but they're like, they have way more
exposed. Yeah. And it's kind of a nice balance because there's other games, I guess, that have done the fully destructible. And it seems like, especially in this game, it would just get to the point where you're on a completely flat battlefield by the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like, you know, certain parts are destructible and they seem logical and they're not to the point where you're just going to break that level being interesting by shooting them, you know? It's not just going to completely level everything in the game.
Yeah.
Which I appreciate because I think, I didn't really play Bad Company. I remember hearing about it.
I played 1943 a bit. Did you play that one?
Just very briefly.
Yeah, same here.
And I think both of those had the everything could get crumbled down to nothing, and that just seemed like going a little too far to make, because it seems like the levels would stop being interesting by halfway through the fight.
Right.
But, yeah. So it's good. I would recommend it. The only thing that sucks is they have that crazy online pass thing, so if you, you know, buy a new copy is what I'm trying to say. Which, I mean, I believe in that anyway, but still.
Or if you can happen to buy a used copy that the $10 for the online pass still makes it cheaper, then you're still good, I guess.
And if you rent it, I ended up having to complain online to Blockbuster, and then they messaged me through Twitter a code, because we rented it first, and you can't play the online, which is the point. I guess there's a campaign, but we have never tried
it. I have never dabbled in a campaign yet, and like I guess through co-op, there's like some special guns you can get.
Oh, yeah.
So like a few times me and our other buddy have been like, oh, so you want to get those guns in the co-op? And then we're just like, nah, let's just play more Conquest mode.
Yeah, pretty much. And there's lots of other modes. That's just the one that we personally, like, really enjoy.
Well, so. That's the one that harkens back to the, you know, Battlefield 1942 sure, days, which exactly. is what we're so into anyway, so.
Yeah, and it's the nice just thing right is, up our alley. With that one, we had to get together a bunch of people on a LAN and to even make it halfway decent.
Yeah.
And this one, that ability to just form up your squad of a couple of people and auto just like quick join a group, you know.
When we were first discussing like what, you know, new multiplayer game we were gonna spend time playing, like that was what clinched it for me was that you have a squad of four within the giant team. I was like, okay, that actually sounds pretty cool.
Also sold Milo really on it. Yeah, it was a great way to go for this type of game. And like I said, we're not big experts on this genre, so maybe other games are also doing this, but this one is the one that really got its hooks into us.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, I guess that'll wrap it up.
I think I've already put like 20 hours into it.
Nice.
And I haven't had it that long.
All righty. Well, don't forget to check out the main site, wingdamage.com. You can email us at podcast@wingdamage.com or follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/wingdamage or follow us on our personal ones. Mine is Spambot, Jesse is Mainfinger, and Adam is the Heatman. And with that, we will see you all next time.
See you later.
Thanks for listening to Barrel Roll. For more information, visit wingdamage.com.
Do a barrel roll!